On the Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, we've got kind of an unusual and interesting program for the Thanksgiving weekend, and that is to talk about the fact that, according to the latest research, the Thanksgiving story that we've passed down for generations now, that might have been a Thanksgiving, but it wasn't the first Thanksgiving, and it wasn't the first gathering of Christians with Native Americans over a meal. To find out more about that, we welcome Kevin Kokemore, who is the author of La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories. It's from Pineapple Press, which is an imprint of Globe Pequo, the trade division of the Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group. And his new book talks about a part of the exploration process of America that we often either forget about or dismiss. And Kevin, my personal guess about that is because we ended up speaking English and not Spanish. But that's ignoring an awful lot, hundreds of years that the Spanish were invested in exploring the southeastern United States, correct?
That's absolutely correct. I think you nailed it. And I think that when you started out by talking about a Thanksgiving as a meeting between Christians and natives, I think that sums it up perfectly, because you're right, that is a meeting of Christians and natives, but they're not Protestants, they're Catholics. And that goes through the very idea that you just said, is that that's one of the reasons why we so easily dismiss these stories, is that they are not English stories, and they're not Protestant stories.
As a matter of fact, and not to sound mean, but the worst, this is what I was taught in Florida history as a kid, the worst example of religious persecution on the North American continent took place long before the English ever showed up, and that was between the French Protestants known as the Huguenots and the Spanish colonists who were Catholic. And that was an extension of the wars that were going on in Europe at the time, but this took place on the South Carolina coast, right?
So the French first showed up in South Carolina, and what you're referring to, you can look at a map on the east coast of Florida, and it reads La Matanza, which pretty directly translated means to massacre. And you're right, that is a spot where, over the course of several days, a bunch of Spanish Catholics hunted down and massacred hundreds of French Protestants, and that is the origin story of St. Augustine. I mean, that is the origin story of Florida, is that of all of the attempts to settle Florida, the one, or anywhere in North America, which is the larger point of the book, is prompted by a non-Catholic Protestant sect, as the Spanish would say. They're Lutherans and they're Calvinists, and that makes them apostates, and I mean, that cannot be allowed to happen. And so one of the general themes of the book, in the early section, one of the early sections where we talk about connections and origins, is that it's really religious forces that drove the settlement of the Southeast. And one of those is this epic battle between these French Huguenot Protestants and Spanish Catholics. Yeah, and that is, if you want to talk about religious intolerance and violence, it doesn't get much worse than that.
Now, to be fair, the French paid them back later on, another group, and then there were the Brits under Sir Francis Drake, right, that attacked and burned St. Augustine. This was a tough place to have a colony.
It was on the edge of the world. I mean, one of the themes that really runs through the book is that St. Augustine endures because it has to endure, because it protects Spain's claim to North America. Otherwise, it was a pretty terrible place. And if you were sent there, you were sent there because you had done something wrong as a soldier, or you were. It was a two-bit sort of colonial backwater, a fraction of the size of other Spanish colonial places. St. Augustine would have been a small pueblo in Mexico City. I mean, it was tiny. But it does endure, and you have others. You have Santa Elena in South Carolina. You have Pensacola. Appalachia. So these were tiny and pretty pathetic places, but they still existed.
I think most people who don't grow up in Florida, you and I both have that honor. You grew up in the Tampa Bay area, where my next down brother has been for many years. And by the way, we're talking to Kevin Kokemore, who is a fourth generation Floridian, earned his bachelor's and master's in history at the University of South Florida, which is in Tampa, and his doctorate in early American history at Florida State. here we have this state that seems to be a potential for great riches for conquistadors, the guys who were like second in command and third in command with the ones that were so successful in Mexico, in Central America, and certainly in South America. These guys did real well for themselves, so their lieutenants think, hey, I want some of that. Let's go to Florida. Unfortunately, they didn't go for the beaches or they would have been happy. Instead, they went for gold, and they didn't find any of that, did they?
No, and you're exactly right. And this is a theme that really connects Florida to other happenings in the Spanish colonial world, is that all of these guys, Pancho de Narvaez, De Soto, they are all pretty successful already. But if you dig into their culture, being second best is not what drives guys like this. And so they hear these legends, they hear these stories, they hear these accounts of these large hierarchical societies in the interior of this place. They don't even know how big it is, but they know from shipwreck victims and from previous explorers, conquistadors, that this place is huge. And if you're in the mind of a Hernando de Soto, the last time that he saw a ruler who lived on top of a mound, it came with silver mines, and it made everybody incredibly wealthy, including him. But what drives him to Florida, and he wagers all of his wealth and all of his prestige, and because he thinks he can be the next Pizarro, and Pancho de Narvaez thinks that he can be the next Cortez. And even before then, Juan Ponce de Leon and Lucas Vazquez de Ayón, the first two to really establish any sort of connection to the Southeast, they think that they're going to be the next Columbus. And that's what really drives them. And, they're almost right, is that there are these huge hierarchical Mississippian chiefdoms. I mean, they're massive. There's, thousands, tens of thousands of people living in Florida, in these communities, and in Georgia, in the Carolinas. But they don't derive their value from gold. They derive their value from corn. And so you can just imagine the anger of these conquistadors that show up in these places that are supposed to have all this wealth. And the chiefdom looks at them and says, we don't do gold, we do corn. And so a huge disappointment, but the connection is obvious. They have tasted the riches of conquest and subjugation, and that made them very powerful, very wealthy men, but they wanted more.
Now, interestingly enough, before their little forays are over, they'll be really happy to see that golden corn, because there's not a lot of provisions as they work through the countryside. And these guys are pretty much used to going from place to place and expecting food and getting fed. And that doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, and it happens enough for them to last years in these places. Not so much with Pancho de Narvaez. His story really ends pretty quickly, and it becomes the story of survival along the beaches, which is really just an incredible epic story that lasts years. I mean, if you just look at a map of the hemisphere or North America, and you look at where Tampa is, and you imagine walking from Tampa to Mexico City, you can imagine what kind of walk that would be.
Wow.
But Hernando de Soto, they last years, and one of the particular insights of the book is that is an incredible damage that they do, is that they survive off of the native communities. And what they do is one community after another, from Florida all the way up to Tennessee and then all the way to Arkansas and Texas, they walk into a community and like locusts, they just consume everything. Their horses consume food, they consume food, and they leave these natives with nothing. And in a native community where the only stability that they have is in corn, when these hundreds of Spaniards come in and just eat everything, I mean, what you're doing is you are almost dooming that community. And
right.
So they just move through, and, there's a lot of violence in the book, like direct violence. But there's also these things that they do that are almost on a long-term scale even worse. And one of those is that they just eat everything and they leave nothing behind.
Right. It's not like they pay for it. They have nothing to pay for it with. They don't expect to pay for it. They expect to
be
treated sort of like honored guests. And for a while, they sort of are. I mean, here are these people that come in. They look very different. They're bearded. They're covered with metal. They're riding horses. All of these things at first were very, very new and startling things for the First Nations people that are in this part of the world. They've never seen anything like it. And maybe there's a certain, you know, fear about it. Like there's just something that we ought to be careful. We should appease them so they'll go away.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, this is an aspect of the Columbian Exchange that really is obvious. I mean, you would have to just close your eyes and imagine never seeing anything like this before, and then seeing, you know, a Spaniard on a horse, which is sitting much, much taller than you, clad in armor that you have nothing that can penetrate it. The armor that natives wear is designed for close combat with blunt clubs. It's not designed to protect you from metal tips. I mean, it's not even the guns that they carry, but it's the long swords and the pikes that they carry. And, you know, a Spaniard on a horse covered with armor, both the horse and the Spaniard. By the way, he's got a 150-pound Irish wolfhound that's also covered in armor and is trained to attack you and basically rip your throat out. And he also has this pike that he's, this long sort of thrusting sword that he's able to thrust down. I mean, that's like a Sherman tank. They have no defense against that. And if you line about 20 or 30 of those up and you rush into a community, you can utterly destroy the community. And that's how Spaniards are able to overwhelm large numbers of natives, is A, that this is just so astounding. I mean, it's like aliens coming. And B, if it did get violent, what a native would have to do to kill a Spaniard would have to just get incredibly lucky. And we know that they're fierce fighters and incredible warriors, and they're very, very agile and very knowledgeable and very deadly with the weapons that they have. But the weapons that they have are no match for the weapons that the Spaniards have. And so, you know, if everything goes right, then it's only mildly confrontational. But when things go wrong, the violence can be almost unbelievable.
Now, we're talking, in case you're joining us late, we're talking to Kevin Kokomore, Dr. Kevin Kokomore, who is the author of La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories from Pineapple Press. Kevin's has also recently published Of One Mind and Of One Government, The Rise and Fall of the Creek Nation in the Early Republic with the University of Nebraska Press. I throw a little plug in for them because I review a lot of books for them as well. So one of the things that you talk about in the book is that a lot of the first that we associate with the English really originated with the Spanish. We mentioned the earliest Thanksgiving-style meal between indigenous people and explorers from Europe, that it occurred almost a century before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, that the barbecue basically would eventually come from this Spanish and Native American traditions being combined in the vast area that was La Florida, and that the Spanish were the first to bring slaves because they couldn't convince the Indians to work for free after a while, and so they brought slaves that they bought from the Portuguese who got them from Africa. And so a lot of the bad things that we always say, well, that originated with the British, that's not true, sadly enough. It was there over a century before anybody from Great Britain even thought about sailing over to the New World.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So if Thanksgiving sort of is the intro, what I end with is this moment in 1619 where you have the sale of the first unfree people from West Africa to Virginia, and that really kicks off what we now know as slavery in the English colonies. And that certainly is a very important first, and Virginia did grow to be much bigger than Florida, and that was the English culture that spread. But that being said, that there is an important Spanish connection through Florida, and that is the Atlantic slave trade. The Atlantic slave trade that we know now as the Atlantic slave trade is really what we would refer to academically as the second one. The first one was the 15th century, so you're talking 1400s, the 15th century to the early 17th century, and it's Spanish because This is, you know, it's a really devastating history of the Caribbean or Latin America. And when disease and exploitation really destroys the native population of the Caribbean islands and Central and South America, the Spaniards look to their Portuguese trading partners and the west coast of Africa, and they begin the first Atlantic slave trade, which goes to the Caribbean. Most of the second Atlantic slave trade also goes to the Caribbean. So this is, it's not that different. And the first one is much smaller than the second one, but even the story of 1619 and Virginia's connection to the Atlantic slave trade is that the pirates that sold human beings to Virginia had just stolen them from a Spanish ship going to the through the Caribbean. And it connects. Even all of these stories have Spanish threads to them. And I end with the story of the slave ship that was really a pirate ship, and the pirate ship was only there because it was preying on Spanish shipping off of the coast of La Florida, and it sails right past St. Augustine on its way to Virginia. And if it and when it passed by St. Augustine, it is passing by a colony which has had slavery from West Africa, from Luanda, the same port in West Africa as the enslaved people who were sold to Virginia, the exact same port, had existed in St. Augustine for 100 years. And by that time, there were several generations of slavery. So the real incredible sort of first there is that if there is an early, early history of slavery, there's a history of the first births of both white and black Americans and African Americans, and all of these things were happening in Florida before they were happening further to the north.
There are some good things that happened first in Florida, too. We mentioned the first Thanksgiving was in Florida. Also, the first Underground Railroad, that is to say, a way to get enslaved people free by working them through surreptitious channels until they got to freedom. That got started in St. Augustine as well.
The really complicated thing about Spain and about Spanish colonialism is that the Spanish, I make clear in the introduction, and I'll make clear now, is that this is not a triumphant narrative. This is not this is not supposed to make Hispanic culture triumphant, or any sort of narrative like that. But it is extremely, the Spanish relationship to slavery is extremely complicated. And the Spanish relationship to any group that the Spanish viewed as inferior was incredibly complicated. And you have at the same time a Spanish culture that completely did have chattel slavery, the ownership of people as property, the same way the English had. But at the same time, there were avenues of freedom within Spanish society. Serving in the military, Catholicism. And so the Spanish see the English in South Carolina, and they see the growth of rice and the plantation culture. They see the growth of South Carolina, and they are looking for ways to counter that, to stifle that. And all of a sudden, these groups of runaway slaves show up in St. Augustine. And the governor looks around and says, if you get baptized and become Catholic, we will free you. You have to work. You'll get paid wages. And that creates people, that spreads. The king officially sanctions it, and word spreads up through Georgia into South Carolina. And so what you have is, it's complicated, it's difficult, and this is why I use the term the Underground Railroad, because it is resistance to slavery. It is the fleeing of people through the swamps. It's incredibly inhospitable. There are no way stations. There are no people. No one's going to help you. But if you can escape down the coast to St. Augustine, then if you jump through a couple hoops, you will become free. And the way that that destabilizes South Carolina is the point, is that that is a weapon that the Spanish used against the British in South Carolina. And it turns out to be incredibly effective, as we know from the Stono Rebellion in 1739, when hundreds of slaves rise up and they're burning their way south through the rice plantations on the Stono River. And the whole time they are waving flags and beating drums and saying, we are marching to St. Augustine. So it is a weapon that the Spanish use. They use freedom and that spreads, and it's highly effective.
You know, that's just what the British did in South Carolina and North Carolina during the American Revolution. They offered enslaved people the chance to be free men if they would fight for them, in one of those real ironies of history. I will say something else that, and I'm not a historian, okay? I'm just a guy who likes history. I read a lot of books. I'm not a researcher or anything. But I will note, I have noticed that there is kind of a propensity to look at what happened with the colonization of the New World with a particularly grim look, and I don't mean to take anything away from all the people who got diseases from the Spanish or the English or the Dutch or the French, and it killed them. I'm not diminishing any of that. But I would temper it by saying, as far as treating people that you conquer badly, this is not something that was invented in the colonization of the place we now call the United States, that's for sure. I mean, if you read the history of Europe, there was always one group running over another group and enslaving them or killing them all. And nobody ever said, you know, nobody centuries later said, we apologize for being mean to you. They just said, hey, that's just tough. Get over it. It only seems in the United States, and maybe this is part of our culture, that we feel bad in retrospect that terrible things happened and that we are, you know, have sort of the recipients of the largesse of having those things occur before we lived. Is that accurate, or do you say no, that it really was enormously different than anything anywhere else?
No, I wouldn't disagree with anything necessarily that you've said. I think that if you look at, and this goes, I guess, to all of the politics around a lot of these really important anniversaries like 1776, or which is coming up, or 1621 or 1619. Mm-hmm. And as a professional sort of teaching historian, you know, we're not trying to poke holes or make anybody feel tremendously bad, but you know, history is not necessarily this objective thing. It is something that flows through people's minds. It's something that they interact with. It's something that they have to create using sources. And so it's in the interpretation of events changes over time. And so, this book is an attempt to do that. It's not an attempt to destroy what we think of as Thanksgiving or what we think of as Americans' heritage, but it is an attempt to complicate it, to basically show people that it's not that simple, and in a lot of ways it is more problematic. It could have been more complicated. It could have been there. It's not all this universal march of progress that you get this idea from. It's not all triumphant. It's messy, and there are a lot of voices that were involved, and there were a lot of groups that made the country the way it was. And I hope that answers your question.
Yes.
But I think that's something that I know that I've tried to do with this book I'm not trying to insult anyone. I'm certainly not in trying to say that the Spanish were better than anyone else. But I think that when you add these groups in, it does make for a more complex, a more rich, a better, more accurate story.
For example, if I hadn't lived in the section of Florida where I grew up, then I would never have heard of the Timucuan Indians, because they, for all intents and purposes, I'm assuming they do not exist anymore. A lot of the little tribes for which things are named in Florida, the Talapesi and so forth, those groups don't exist anymore. But a new group came to be, and they in some cases were descendants of those, or the remnants, I guess would be more fair to say, of these other tribes, the Seminoles. And the Seminole tribe very proudly says they're the only Native American tribe that never surrendered to the United States of America. They folded back into the Everglades, and the U.S. just said, it's not worth the trouble to fight these guys anymore. We'll just let them have it.
Yeah, so again, we're not trying to whitewash over anything or dull anything down, but this is an excellent example, and I had some scholars that worked with me on my language and said, in a lot of ways, some of these smaller groups that you're talking about, the Ocali or the Patano in North Florida, or the mm-hmm. Caluso or the Ais or Timucua or Timucua, these groups, a lot of times, the political groups that they collapsed, and it's hard to say they didn't.
Yeah.
But at the same time, without that collapse, you would not have, and this is a couple chapters in the book,
right,
is that this collapse led to the coalescence of new groups that we know now as Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws. So in Alabama, you would have the sort of a border between the Creek mm-hmm. and the Choctaw.
Right.
And or to the north, you would have the Cherokee. To the northwest, you'd have the Chickasaw. To the southeast, you'd have the Creek or the Seminole. And these are really the refugee combatant groups that are a direct response to the collapse of the Mississippian world, which is what Spaniards sort of set in motion. So, you know, with that collapse, we have to be honest and say that was a collapse. It was a violent, destructive event. Mm-hmm. We don't even really know how many people died because we don't have primary source records for that. But it's not the end of the world, and it's not the end of the story. It is actually it's the end of one chapter and the beginning of another. In the case of the Seminole in Florida, move down and they look around Gainesville and they say, "This is amazing. This place is amazing. We're going to stay here. We're not going to go back to Georgia and Alabama." And they are moving in to the ruins of the older Mississippian peoples that live there. And so there's no better example of the transformative effect. It is violent. It is absolutely destructive, but at the same time, it is a formative event as well. And you would not have Seminoles without this moment.
Right. Now, and really, I know we didn't get to dwell on this very much. I kind of mentioned it in passing, but you spend a considerable amount of time talking about how cattle raising basically was a creation of the cattle that the Spanish brought with them that then roamed free, and then Native Americans in the Panhandle area started being herders of them. The cattle industry, as we know it, also got its start in Florida. And so there's so very much in this book. For those of us in Alabama, which is so close to Florida, borders on it for a pretty good distance, it behooves us to know more about our southern neighbor and to realize that once upon a time, what is now the state of Florida was not all that was in La Florida, and that it has a fascinating and decidedly Spanish past. So if you were hoping for me to ask a question of you and I did not ask it, what would you like that question to be? How would you like to answer it?
I don't know. This is a great conversation. I off the top of my head, I think I'm glad you ended with the Seminole, because that's something that what we talked about really sort of brings us forward into the 21st century.
Yeah.
I think that it's not all doom and gloom, like you say. It's I throw the food in there as a way to sort of as an homage to these oldest of traditions that you can still downright enjoy, right?
Yeah.
I say that.
Yeah.
It's great, but between the pigs and the cattle and the orange juice, you know, that's a nod to the Spanish colonial history that is not so it's not so depressing.
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin, it's a fascinating book. I really enjoyed it a great deal, and I am going to now get a hold of the University of Nebraska Press and say, "Hey, you've got an author, and he has a book. Since it's newly published, I'm going to see if they'll send me a copy of that book. Maybe we can talk on that as well."
Sir, we certainly should, because the Creek Nation is something that has an extremely close tie to Florida, Western Georgia, and Alabama. So
yes.
that is something that it's not as early. It's a little bit more of an academic book.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for making time to be with us, and I wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
I appreciate it. I will say, in closing, that we already missed the Spanish one. The Spanish one was in September, so we might
as
well go ahead and enjoy the English one.
Fair enough. Thank you. You have a website?
It's just my name, Kevin Kokemore. Yep, and then you can find the book there, some information about me. I have some links to my my Coastal Carolina University webpage and stuff like that. So
excellent.
That's a one-stop.
All right, very good. Kevin, again, thanks very much. Enjoyed the book. I look forward to doing this again sometime.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So thanks for joining us today for our special little Thanksgiving show on WTBF and on thebookshelf.podbean.com. We'll see you next week. And remember, we'll be going into the season of Advent, preparing for Christmas. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Jacques Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.